Spark, stories from advocates for global change, a podcast from the Swiss Young Academy.
Hello and welcome to the next series of Spark. We are back with three episodes on a new topic, another big challenge of our time, human rights. Today, I'm joined with Julia.
Hi Tanish, nice to talk to you again. We will dive into the topic of human rights. The challenge I see with human rights is that they have to work for everyone on the planet, which means juggling a huge range of different needs and priorities. So how can we create a fair world for all? How do we ensure that minorities are considered? And who should even be in charge of defining those rights?
Absolutely, Julia. And human rights aren't just a global issue. They hit close to home for many of us. It's something that shapes the way we interact with each other and the world around us.
In the search for answers and with great interest in this important topic, we met three people who are actively working in the field of human rights. From a professional background, they are all lawyers or legal experts, which led us to wonder whether it is necessary to study law in order to engage in this topic. This question will be discussed in more detail later in this episode. And of course, we want to hear about their core motivation for fighting for the rights of others. I met Erika Schlappi, who is an expert consultant on human rights, specializing in the topic of women rights and governance issues.
And I met Markus Schäfer, who is a professor for constitutional and administrative law at the University of Basel and a strong advocate for persons with disabilities.
We also had the help of Zora for this episode. She is a student of life science engineering at the EPFL in Lausanne. And she met with Stefan Schlegel, who is the director of the recently founded Swiss Human Rights Institution in Fribourg. His specialization lies in migration law, but the institution contributes to the protection and promotion of all human rights. Let's start with him.
Zora met him in December at his office, which was as new as the institution.
The creation of the Swiss Human Rights Institution was actually a historic moment in Switzerland because it took over 20 years to found it. And that is, although having such an institution for protection and promotion of human rights is actually recommended by the UN General Assembly. And around the world, 120 states already have it.
It looks like such an institution was long overdue. So let's jump into the interview and hear more about it from Stefan.
Okay, well then, to start off, could you introduce yourself with name and function?
I'm Stefan Schlegel. I'm the director of the Swiss National Institution for Human Rights. I started in this position in February this year.
So I think originally you studied law. Can you maybe tell us about what motivated you to do so?
So I have a very early fascination, I think, for the specific topic of human rights. I think that even as a child, when I was confronted with that topic, it had an enormous attraction to me. I always found it very plausible that human rights are a means to improve the world, to improve the fate of human beings, but generally, the idea of someone who has the capacity to speak on behalf of others and defend their rights, speaking up for others, seemed to be a role to me of a responsible and capable human being and someone who has purpose in his life. And that is what attracted me.
So it seems you were born and grew up in Switzerland as a native Swiss. So why did you decide to pursue a thesis specifically in migration law?
I'm quite often asked that. And in a way, it's to me a somewhat puzzling question for two reasons. One is that I think it would be odd and rather problematic also if people would only be scientifically interested in things that have a very close relationship to their biography. And the second point is that I always find it a bit hard to describe this interest because it seems so obvious to me that it is a highly fascinating topic. I mean, migration specifically is such a showcase of so many interesting questions. It's about human fate, it's about human destiny, it's about family life, it's about who belongs, it's about the most fundamental questions of justice. It's about, among the most politicized questions that there is. So I find it so self-evident that this is a highly interesting question that I'm often a bit at a loss to describe what attracted me to it first.
So recently, you were elected as director of the newly founded Swiss Human Rights Institution, where we are right now. So what would you say are the objectives of this new institution?
So the objectives of this institution are to protect and to promote human rights in Switzerland. Such institutions form part of the international human rights architecture. So Switzerland took a long time to grant itself with such an institution, but these institutions are a wheel in the machinery of human rights protection internationally, and they're recommended for in documents of the UN.
Do you have an example of a recent project that you're working on?
So the institution itself is extremely recent,
which is why
we don't have any finished projects at this point in time. But we do have a lot of projects that get started. And so we have different roles. We have the role to be a forum where human rights issues in Switzerland can be debated and where people can learn from each other. Mm-hmm. And then we also have the role of a critical observer where we can point to deficiencies, to challenges, to unaddressed problems and insist that these problems be addressed. We have the role of being a seismograph, that is sort of an early warning system for tendencies that might be a structural challenge to human rights. And then finally, we have the role of being a center of competence, a center of expertise. And in that specific role, one very concrete project one could point to is a series of workshops we'll be holding at the beginning of next year, which address the question, how does the federal system of Switzerland respond to the demand of the international system to file specific reports? So there are specific reports regarding the rights of women, regarding the rights of children, against racism and so forth that are due. And many of the details of these reports have to be filed by cantons, where a lot of the, you know, human rights relevant work in Switzerland is being done. But there's a large distance between the UN and the cantons, and a lot of possible misunderstandings and, you know, just energy lost on the way. And helping cantons better to understand what their obligations are and what the need of the information that they have to file, and vice versa, better help to understand the UN, the federalist system of Switzerland, is such an early project that we have. Mm.
So before becoming the director of this institution, you were part or even among the founders of multiple initiatives, such as the think tank Voraus, a think tank on foreign policy, as well as Operation Libero, a political movement for a world open and future-driven Switzerland. What would you say these projects have in common, seeing that you decided to dedicate yourself to all of them?
I guess what I've been interested in always was to break out of conventional ways of thinking about problems and to address problems from a new angle, from a new perspective. That's why I'm interested in scientific work, because at least in social sciences, what it essentially does is coming up with new questions, coming up with new perspectives. And that is something that can be done in science. It can be done in practical work, like in the work on human rights and the defense of human rights. And it can also be done in politics. And that's what drove me to be involved in these initiatives. So thinking about new ways of approaching the big topics in Swiss politics, like its relationship to Europe or its migration politics for that matter, is highly creative work and work that always attracted me.
How do you cope with the disappointments and setbacks that are certainly a part of working with the government and the public?
I don't think that I have a good strategy other than being prepared for setbacks, knowing that all the projects I'm involved in, like scientific work, is extremely slow work. Political work is extremely slow work. It's extremely, you know, hard to make any progress, and even harder to point to progress that is due to your specific work, so that you can really tell with a degree of certainty that is my or our specific contribution. That will always be very hard, even if things are fine, even without major setbacks. So it's very important to go into that kind of work already with a, you know, with a mental resilience that setbacks and disappointments will rather be the rule than the exception.
So that makes the next question a bit challenging, but what is the achievement you're the most proud of, if there is one?
So there are instances where you can tell in this specific debate, people with some degree of power, people with some degree of influence have picked up a narrative, a soundbite, a way of framing a problem that has first been hatched out in my laptop or in the group in which I happen to work. It's rather rare. The contrary is more frequent, but there have been instances where this happened and, well, they help nourishing for future projects.
So I will now make a transition to something a bit more general, some more general thoughts on human rights and migration law in Switzerland. So the first question in this context, why do we need an organization like the Swiss Human Rights Institution in Switzerland? One could ask, aren't human rights already broadly protected and respected in Switzerland?
The main reason why such an institution is needed is not that it is required by international standards, but that human rights are never a given. Human rights are never a state of things. They're always an achievement, and they're an achievement that is always in danger, and an achievement that always has to be reconquered generation for generation. And I think looking back on this first year, we've been operational with this landmark court case of the Klimaseniorinnen against Switzerland and the backlash against it.
A quick remark to explain what Stefan Schlegel is referring to. In the case of the Klimaseniorinnen, the European Court of Human Rights ruled that Switzerland is pursuing an inadequate climate policy and thus is violating the human rights of the senior women that went to court. The court says it does not protect the senior women enough from the consequences of global warming. Then, with backlash, Stefan means the fact that the Federal Council and the Swiss Parliament have actually criticized the ruling and defend themselves against it.
You know, a backlash that came not only from the right wing of the political spectrum, but right from the middle of Swiss politics, from its very government, from its very parliament, is quite a vivid reminder that human rights are not just here to stay and are not just here as a given, but something for which a consensus has to be reconquered time and time again. And being a pacemaker for this process is the first and foremost task of a national human rights institution.
So that fits very well with the question, does a final definition of human rights even exist, or is it rather something that's dynamic?
So human rights cannot be, I mean, you can define human rights, but then you have an abstract definition of human rights and not a list of human rights. You can find lists of human rights in legal documents, and legal documents are the most important reference for our work, of course. But if you read those legal documents as the relevant chapter in the Swiss Constitution or the European Convention of Human Rights, which is in force since 50 years for Switzerland. So if you read those texts, you'll find them very concise, very short. They say something like academic freedom is guaranteed. And so you can come up with a definition that lists all these guarantees, but that doesn't give you an answer on the question, where does academic freedom begin and where does academic freedom end? Or it doesn't give you an answer on the question, does a right to private life include a protection against inactivity when it comes to climate protection? These are things that have to be hammered out in a much more concrete fashion on a case-by-case basis. There is very little alternative to this case-by-case work. That is work that has to be done by courts. And those courts have to be respondent to two things that are time-sensitive. One is the development of society at large. It's a fact that societies do evolve and they change their attitude to things like corporal punishment or how to deal with homosexuality in a society. And so the nature of human rights and the exact concrete content of human rights has to adapt to such developments in societies. And the other factor in which human rights are time sensitive are new challenges that cannot have been foreseen by those who drafted a human rights text, a human rights convention. An example that comes to mind, of course, is artificial intelligence and all the other topics in relationship with digitalization. Another example I could give here is, of course, climate change. So what the European Court of Human Rights did this year was not so much a stretching of the concept of human rights, but rather the adaptation of this concept of human rights on a comparatively new challenge for the protection of human dignity and human freedom.
Who defines human rights?
So human rights are not something that is hanging in the orbit. You know, there's a traditional school on human rights that tends to think so. Especially the French tradition of human rights thinks that human rights are natural laws. So they only have to be uncovered and declared. So that's why they have a Déclaration des droits humains. They only have to be declared. The disadvantage of this approach, of course, is that there are very different concepts of what can be found up there in the clouds. So there can be very contradictory views of what is given, what is detached from human negotiations. Mm. So I tend to think that human rights are the result of a contradictory process, of a political process. They are laid down in law, so they are the result of a political process, which is why they also have to rely at the end of the day on a political consensus. If this political consensus is lost over time, the protection that human rights can guarantee us will be lost as well. So one of the central difficulties when talking about human rights is that those most urgently and most directly in need of human rights protection tend to be the most marginalized in society, and therefore also those whose voices are most easily overheard. And we should therefore always start when talking about human rights from the working hypothesis that indeed someone is missing and that we should double our efforts to get these people on the table as well.
How objective are you as a scientist in a topic like migrant law that is politically very controversial?
So I said at the beginning that I'm not biographically drawn to this issue. But of course, that's only half the truth. And once you get invested in a project, it becomes part of your biography and it shapes you as much as you shape your subject. So in that sense, all scientific interest is biographical, and you bring your own set of experiences to the topic, and that defines the perspective you can have on it. Now, that is true for everybody, not just for me, and it is true for all scientific issues, subjects, not just for those who are very hardly exposed to the wind of politics. So I think it would be good to be very skeptical of the notion of objectivity. Often the notion of objectivity is used as a tool to create a difference in power. There's a very strong tendency to think that defending the status quo in any scientific subject is somehow objective. And coming up with new frames or new questions or new demands is somehow not objective or somehow activist. But there's nothing neutral about the status quo. It's just the result of power relations as they happen to be right now. There's nothing neutral about that, and there's nothing objective about that. So rather than asking the question, how objective are you? I think the question would be, how self-reflecting are you about your biases? How careful are you in overcoming and minimizing your biases? And if the question is asked thus, then I can tell with a degree of confidence, well, I work hard in overcoming my own biases. I work hard on, you know, integrating views that are uncomfortable to me, integrating data that is uncomfortable to me in my scientific thinking, and that's probably the best I can do.
As someone young, if I wanted to get active in a similar way, to get engaged, is it necessary to study law?
It's not necessary, but it certainly helps a great degree. So power in society is imposed via rules, and being familiar with rules, being familiar with how rules are made, how rules are changed, gives you a proximity to power or a good set of tools to challenge power. It's not a coincidence that so many politicians, so many people in the administration, so many people generally in positions of power have a background in law. So many of the most effective spokespersons of the marginalized do have a background in law as well. But I would recommend law, and there are many more ways nowadays to do that than when I started university, is to look for ways to combine law something else, to have a law and approach, a law and anthropology, or a law and sociology, or a law and economy approach to your future profile, because it gives you that toolbox and it gives you this proximity to rules and therefore to power, but also a broader and oftentimes a more vivid perspective of human affairs. So there are many masters who offer nowadays this sort of combination. And I often regret that when I was at university, it was still a much more closed discipline.
So to finish, what motivates you to put your effort into a more open Switzerland, even though there is sometimes strong political force against it?
Well, one obvious answer is my children. They have to grow up here and they have to flourish here. But it's not just them. I think it's the upcoming generations in general that are, for any kind of political effort that is sincere, the most important motivation. That's not true just for me, but for everybody. And there are legitimate differences in visions, what country, what Switzerland would be desirable for future generations. I personally happen to be convinced that Switzerland linked and involved in the world, open for innovation, open for self-improvement, is one that can provide more opportunities for more people, more capacity for human flourishing.
Thank you.
That was a very interesting topic. What are your thoughts, Julia?
What inspires me from hearing about his work is his consciousness about bias and the importance of including as many different perspectives as possible. And this seemed to me to be a key requirement to really work on the rights for everyone. What do you take away from the interview, Tanish?
I found Stefan's point interesting about how we can combine different fields with law, such as economics and sociology, and how that can actually increase our understanding of human rights and migration laws.
We'll discuss these and other aspects of human rights in the next two episodes.
That was the first of three episodes about this topic. In the next episode, we are going to hear from Erika Schleppi and her work in promoting women's rights and gender equality.
Hear you next time.
And thanks for listening.
Spark. Stories from advocates for global change. A podcast from the Swiss Young Academy. Hosted by Julia Knuchel, Tanish Shingi and Zora Althaus. Produced by the Podcast Schmiede.